attention, please.
Hey, thanks for coming back again to check out Back in the Village, the Prisoner podcast. Today we're covering A, B, and C. Before we start, I just want to give a quick thanks to Rick at the Unmutual, who gave us a nice plug on their website. They cover all things The Prisoner. You can find them at theunmutual.co.uk. So, without further ado, here is A, B, and C. Enjoy! Good morning, good morning. Welcome again to Back in the Village, the Prisoner podcast. I'm Clay McCormick from EatDeadMeat.com, and with me, as always, is Wes Teasdale.
Hey guys, how's it going?
From the PenskeyFile.com.
The third bottle of vodka working its way through us.
16 credits, non-alcoholic vodka.
That's right, I forgot, they don't drink alcohol here. How's it going with you?
Good, good. A little bit tired.
Yeah.
Not sleeping too well because of being tampered with.
But yeah. Had any good dreams lately?
Yeah. Obviously, today we will be talking about A, B, and C, which is the third episode of The Prisoner we'll be covering. Let's get into it. It was written by Anthony Skeen and directed by Pat Jackson and features a new number two whose name is Colin Gordon. And, it's actually interesting right off the bat. There is a little slight difference to the opening credits yet again that,
felt a little longer this time.
Well, it's actually not that. It's one of the reasons, jumping way ahead, why people think that there's an alternate order that I keep talking about this alternate order that people think.
Yeah, I'll give my opinion after you finish your thought here.
Who are you?
I am number two.
Who is number one?
You are number six.
When number two introduces himself, he does not say, "I am the new number two." He says, "I am number two." Because, spoiler alert, he is a number two in another episode we haven't covered yet.
Oh, okay.
I don't remember how he introduces himself in that one. He may say the same thing. I'm not sure. I can't remember. But that is one of the reasons why people mess with the order and stuff.
Yep. And as I was watching it, I felt that, and you explained last week that the Canadians, for whatever reason, aired Big Ben as their season finale, or however they broke it down.
Right.
I thought there was a lot of plot in this one that makes sense as to why this episode was either produced first or should have been aired before Big Ben.
Interestingly enough, this was one of the later episodes to be written and, or not, I don't know, written, but later episodes to be produced.
To shot? Okay.
Yeah.
Because he's, he seemed much more together in Big Ben. This one, he is thrown for a loop. What seems to be a majority of the episode. He sort of regains his footing later on as things go by, but he seemed much more calm and collected in Big Ben as if he had been there for a while. And a couple of the things that happened in this episode made me think that he seemed much newer to the whole experience of the village.
That's really interesting you say that, because I have the exact opposite thoughts.
Oh, really?
But we can talk about that a little bit later.
Number two here. Yes, sir, I am doing my best. He's very difficult. I know it's important, sir. He's no ordinary person, sir, but if I had a free hand... I know, sir, yes. I know I'm not indispensable.
Let's talk about number two.
Yeah.
What'd you think of this number two?
Well, you can never trust a man who drinks room temperature milk out of a pitcher. That's the first problem. He had much less of an impact than the Big Ben number two. He's almost a tertiary character here because the lady scientist is almost more important than he is in the grand scheme of things. And as a general character, he's just sort of like snooty. He's snootier. That he's the sort of like upper class, upper crust number two that we haven't seen yet.
Yeah, I think what sets him apart is, you know, one of the things we've been talking about so far is talking about the differences in approach. Each number six has to number each number two has to number six, and Leo McKern last week was much more broad and very welcoming.
Yep.
This one, it seems to me like he's the first number two who's actually done some critical thinking about number six, because he has he's actually worked out he's come to the conclusion that he thinks six resigned because he was switching sides.
Mm-hmm.
And he has gone through Six's file or whatever and come up with three possible, well, to be fair, it's like 2.5 possible targets of people that that Six would then sell his secrets to.
Right.
And the other thing that's interesting about this number two for me is he seems to be the first one who is getting direct pressure from a superior.
Yes. Through an ever-increasing in size phone.
Yeah. I have noticed that too, actually.
It's like they have like 10 extra pounds or whatever on the budget. They're like, make the phone a little bigger.
Make the phone bigger.
That'll be excellent. But yeah, he's also the most concerned about his job.
Yes.
Than any of the other three or four number twos that we've seen. I don't know if I got the impression that he was the most analytical. I thought he was the most neurotic and the most concerned about what was going to happen. Where with the other number twos, you never really got the impression that their job was on the line. Mm. It almost seemed like they were just going, you know, each episode they're a different one just because that's the way it works. And this guy actually makes it sound like if he doesn't do it, they bring a new number two in.
Right.
Which the previous number twos didn't really give me that impression.
Right. And I'm not exactly positive, but I think, well, if it's not the first time that they show number two directly talking to a superior, it is definitely the first time that he has felt pressured by him.
Yeah.
And, you know, that pressure is important to the story because it drives, whereas in Charms of Big Ben, number two, as we talked about, is sort of playing a chess match with number six.
Mm-hmm.
This number two is,
it's much more of a bureaucrat.
Yeah.
Like, I get the number two in the Big Ben was running the show. Mm-hmm. This guy is not running the show. He's just sort of like administrating or being in like an administrator over the process that gets it done.
Right.
Which is a big difference.
And he's really, he's forced to try a new experimental procedure to try and extract
the secrets
from Six.
Yep.
Which, I don't know how often they've done this at this point in sci-fi, but I mean, this episode was basically number six in Inception.
Right. I wrote down Inception / Total Recall / James Bond is what
which
happens.
I would watch that movie. Are you kidding me?
No, it's definitely Inception. In sort of a like a lo-fi version where you can't go into the dream. You can just talk over a telephone to someone who's in the dream, which is like a very base level type of Inception thing. But I guess the general plot here is that the number two and number one and number 14, who's the lady scientist, have come up with a way where they can get into his number six's dreams and make him go through various scenarios, hoping that he will give up his secrets.
Right. They two has narrowed it down to three possible people that six would have sold his information to.
Right.
All of whom frequent the lavish parties of this one character named Madame Ongadine, who's this, you know, over the top French lady.
Yep.
And so that party is the setting that they construct, much like they do in Inception. They actually construct a dream,
right?
But
they have limited control, which I thought was funny. It's kind of a monkey wrench where, like, his first dream sequence, they're number two and 14 are watching on the screen, and he's like, and number six in the dream is like, I'm gonna leave, and they're like, stop him from leaving. He's like, it's his own dream, I can't stop him from leaving. And it's like a limited amount of control that they have over his actual information that he gives. He was also a bizarre dreamer. Number six
Well, it's actually pretty fun because, as you're saying, they have limited control. So basically, all they can do is construct the environment for the dream and insert the character they think he's going to sell out to.
Yeah, yeah.
And then all they can do from that point, well, at least to begin with, is sit back and watch how it plays out.
Yes.
So
through a third party camera angle, yeah, because they're not watching it through Six's eyes. They're watching it from a distance.
Following the great television and movie tradition of video cameras or dreams having the same camera movement as a fully edited TV show.
Well, you know how in, I don't know if you know this, but like it's sort of a mind-blowing thing in, you know, Mario Kart, mm-hmm. the video game series?
Yeah.
The camera in that is shot through the little Lakitu guy, the little guy that rides around in the cloud.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you change the camera angle or something, you can see him holding the camera in front of the racers in Mario Kart. So I imagine that's what this guy's just kind of flying around in the background of this. But yeah, they shoot it through third party or a third person perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And he also, when he's not under the influence of drugs, is apparently only dreaming the same 5 seconds endlessly.
He dreams in stock footage and he only dreams about the moment he resigns.
Yeah, where he kicks the door open and then puts the envelope on the table and slams his hand on the Which the envelope, what does it say? It says deliver by hand. Personal. It
you
says
know,
like,
honestly, I've never actually even looked.
I froze it, I think. And I think it says something like top secret deliver by
hand.
It
actually says his name and his real name and why he resigned.
Right it's just right there. Zoom.
Yeah.
Enhance.
What's all that about?
Energy from his brain. Thoughts. Like sound waves. Converted into electrical impulses. And finally, into pictures.
This, obviously, like I said last week, you need a level of technological
suspension of disbelief
because you're working through quote unquote futuristic or at least sci-fi technology from a show from 1967.
Before the moon landing.
Yeah, before the moon landing when everything was analog and, and plug in.
Yep.
And yeah, so unlike last week where, well, okay, let's get into the A, B, and C themselves.
Sure.
One of the things that I noticed is that apparently when he's not dreaming about stock footage, he's apparently dreaming about beating the shit out of some dudes.
Yes, he dreams about being James Bond because he is James Bond in this dream sequence. He's got a tuxedo.
Yep.
And he beats the shit out of everybody who gives him any kind of trouble. Not even trouble, they just get in his way and he's punching people out.
And as far as I know, this is the first time they directly reference people being spies.
Yeah.
Because both A and B are referred to as spies.
Yes. This is the first. We haven't even had confirmation that number 6 is a spy.
Right, and we still don't. I mean, he could be...
Yeah, just a government worker or whatever.
Yeah, he could be a
secretary for the prime minister.
Yeah, the guy who just writes everything down. he could be assistant director of Skinner from The X-Files.
Mm-hmm.
And so they give him the first two main constructs they give him are both spies that he knew from his previous life.
Right.
And the first one is a lot more hands-on, a lot rougher approach where talking about these characters is so frustrating because it's just letters and numbers.
The mustachioed homosexual man,
the guy who might be into number 6 for more than just information.
Yeah, I couldn't tell if they were just super British or if he was actually interested in him sexually.
I mean, hey, I don't know what that says about number 6's dreams. But.
Although, I mean, not to distract, but it's he's in a very Bond type sequence here. He's wearing a tuxedo. He's at a fancy party. I judge him a lot by his choice of alcohol. He's drinking what seems to be white wine.
Oh, yes.
Where I was like, wow, that's a huge character. You say a lot by what you write a character to be drinking. Mm. And white wine, I was a little let down that he was drinking white wine.
And that he wasn't drinking just like turpentine with a screw in
it. Yeah, just from the bottle, just be like, bottle of Jack. Get out of my way.
Just finishing everybody else's drinks.
But it's a very fancy party.
Yeah.
And the the party reminds me. Have you ever seen the Eddie Murphy SNL sketch where they have this fancy party? And the only thing I remember is there's more to the sketch, but Eddie Murphy is like the court announcer who announces when the guests come in, and he's wearing that sort of frilly French garb.
Oh, right.
And he says like the Lord and Duchess of Douchebag. Yes.
Oh, that's right, because everybody who comes in is an inventor.
Yep.
The Earl of Sandwich comes in, and then the Lord and Lady Douchebag come in. Like, oh, what have you been working on? It's like, well, you know.
But they were in that exact type.
All of the servants at the party are dressed like 1700s
pre-French Revolution.
Yeah,
it's royalty. Like
the Hellfire Club from X-Men.
But number letter A, you call them the most hands-on.
Yeah,
you just thought he's the most direct.
Yeah, their first approach is very more hands-on, where he confronts Six, tries to, you know, through at this point typical witty banter back and forth, tries to get Six to go to the other side. Yep. Doesn't work, and that's when number 2 and number 14 step in and say, all right, well, we can't let him leave, and insert
delete the door.
Yeah, delete the door, basically. Insert him.
Well, they put in some goons and bring him out.
They kidnap him,
yeah,
basically,
yeah, yeah.
And to bring him over to their side or something. And it ends with Six escaping and beating the crap out of everybody.
Right.
And then...
then waking up sore.
Yeah.
Which I thought was kind of a strange...
Yeah. Well, and Two wants to keep pushing, but, yeah, you know, the number 14 says, oh, they have to leave 24 hours in between.
Yeah, another kind of... Bond type thing, because the female, she's sort of conflicted.
Mm.
And you can't really tell if she's into him or she's like legitimately a doctor who's like, I can't put this man through any more of this.
She's definitely seems like a hired hand.
Yeah.
Even when Six confronts her, well, before they put him under, he wakes up briefly and sees her.
Yeah.
And apparently she magically just puts him back.
She does hand wipe over the face and his eyes just shut and he's got his
Which
little smile.
I thought was only reserved for people who were dead in TV, but apparently not.
She does a Klingon death yell. Yeah.
And so he when he wakes up, he catches sight of her in the village and he confronts her, you know, in his non-direct manner. And and he mentions that last week number 14 was an old lady in a wheelchair. And she's
we had never seen 14, right?
No.
Okay, yeah.
And she just plays it off, but it's clear from her interactions with Six and the way that she works for number 2 that she is someone who has just been brought in to administer this.
Yeah.
Cuz even later when number 2 is kind of pushing things, she's kind of like talking like not under her breath, but she's being kind of a smart ass a little bit.
Yeah, and she's not really jumping on everything he says to do. She's very like a, all right.
Right.
Like, can sort of wander over and get shot number 3 out of the case.
Right. And, you know, so she gives a little pushback, so they do actually don't obliterate his mind on the first night.
It's just too crazy of a dream.
Yeah.
At least I know it wasn't A he was selling out to. No. Let's try the second dose. Let's get on to B.
You must rest first.
How long?
24 hours.
Why?
It's a very dangerous drug. You must have time to readjust.
So he wakes up, and he goes about his business. He meets her, and then he drinks his tea.
Which knocks him right out.
Knocks him right out.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing where I was like, this feels like a much earlier episode, because... Mm-hmm. It seems like he should be suspicious of everything at this point. And he's really not. He drinks that tea. And I don't know if to break this down, he is definitely not aware of what's going on until a little bit into the episode. When he wakes up that second time and looks at the tea, I think that's when he realizes that he's been...
Well, so interesting. So the thing I was thinking about this episode was, I actually think one of the reasons I think that it should be later, or at least... feels later, like that. Maybe I shouldn't say that. The big difference between this episode and Chimes of Big Ben for me is in Chimes of Big Ben, number 6 thinks he's smarter than everybody else, and that ends up being part of his undoing,
right?
Because he never at any point thinks that his plan is going too smoothly,
right? Okay, yeah,
and until he gets back to his office and finds out that it's all been a scam,
right.
In this one, he he's aware that something is going on pretty quickly. As soon as he sees number 14 in the real world and recognizes her from that dream, and he sees the mark on his hand, as soon as he notices the mark on his hand, I think he's like, all right, something's going on.
But that's before he drinks the tea, right? Because I think, I'll agree with that. I think he knows that 14 is up to something, and the little injection site in a very strange place on his arm is is another sign. And then when he wakes up from that second and looks at the, like he dropped the tea cup on the floor, and he's like looking at it. And I think that's when he puts it all together, because that's when he hatches his third plot.
Right.
Which was a little confusing for me.
Yeah. Well, briefly to go through the second plot. The second plot, they do another spy person that he knows. This time it's a woman.
Who he's more smitten with than he seems to dislike number A, or letter A.
At, you know, he's already starting to fight back. They can tell that he's fighting back against that shit that they shot him up with.
Yep.
And so they actually have to be more aggressive in terms of entering the dream. And number two has number 14 do some voiceover through B's mouth.
Right.
Which...
a weird decision, because he seems to know more. He should handle the phone call. Why does he have her
on the phone? One of the things they do say is they don't know whose voice, if it's going to be the B's voice or 14's voice. So I think it would shatter the illusion pretty quickly if B talked and it sounded like number two.
This is a real fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants plan here. Yeah. They have not explored
this. Well, it's an experimental procedure, clearly. Yeah, and so he does the old ask some questions that only the real person would know, and she fails.
Number two's got to look through this binder of information to try to track down. It's like the worst standardized test of all time.
Which the questions he asks may or may not even be like legit questions, because he asks about the woman's son, and the guy's like, well, and number two is like, well, I knew she had a husband, but doesn't say anything in here about a son.
Yeah.
So, he could have made that up. But anyway, regardless, that dream also ends with number six beating the shit out of some guys.
We all make mistakes. Sometimes we have to.
Have you the feeling that you're being manipulated?
Manipulated?
Why?
They're here.
Yeah. Much more unnecessary. I didn't get... I mean, they obviously are, like, confronting him.
Yeah.
But he certainly takes the initiative in this ass kicking.
Well, I think it's actually very similar to Inception, how they talk about Inception when, you know, kind of like when the body is rejecting something, when the dream realizes there's an intruder,
right?
It like sends things after you, like antibodies or something.
Yeah.
And so I think, again, those goons were either his own construct of how do I deal with this situation?
Yeah.
Or it could have just been, again, them pushing. It's tough because they do say that everything, all they can do is introduce A, B, and C.
Yep.
And then everything else after that just plays out how it would.
Yep.
So apparently he's just constantly expecting to have to throw down.
And right. And but
tear some ass.
And at a certain point, he is lucidly dreaming because he is totally in control of whatever situation is coming in. And I feel from the second dream sequence on, it should have been the Inception, you know, like just guns in a briefcase kind of thing, like, and just going completely nuts.
Well, I mean, if he did that, then they'd know that he was
that they're onto the plan, yeah.
But yeah, so once he wakes up from the second dream, he knows what's going on. He sees the second puncture thing, and then he follows 14 and makes his way into the laboratory where he sees the drug, and then...
Yes.
Waters it down so it'll apparently be less powerful on him for the next night.
Yeah. It just ties into why I think it seems like a earlier episode, because he's in that lab sort of like got that look on his face like, oh my God, what's been happening?
Mm.
For a very long time. He's like following wires around to see where they hook up, and he watches the TV, which is his dream, is on the TV. Which, it's like, I think Chimes of Big Ben was a better episode than this one. There's a lot of plot weirdness, which I think is inevitable when you start getting into like dream sequence type stuff. Like you have a hard time getting around it. But if he's dreaming the dream, why is the dream on the TV? If he's not creating that dream? Are they inserting him into this program and he's dreaming?
The dream of the party?
Of the party. Because the dream of the party is just sort of running in the background. And yeah. He looks at it.
At the beginning, they talk about having constructed that. So that dream, the party itself is a dream construct of number two.
And he just gets plugged into
it. Yeah, he just gets plugged into it.
Okay. Yeah, and then he waters down his drug with what looks like pure water.
I think it's just water.
He takes a very, very big risk.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's too bad Amy's not here, because I would love to get her opinion, as she being a nurse, whether or not it's okay to just inject yourself with straight water.
Well, that too, he didn't do the little tap thing that I know all movies you must do. He didn't do that, and he also just... He's in a lab, and he just picks up a beaker of a clear substance and injects it into the thing.
It could have been hydrogen peroxide anything.
It could have been sulfuric acid or something. Yeah. It's just like he took a serious risk, and it's also clear, yet when it's injected into him later, it has that purple color again, which I think is a shooting error, but it's hard to tell.
You know, it's funny, because when I've been watching this on the Blu-ray, and when we were watching it today, I noticed the first time they show the syringes, there's no color in the fluid.
The very first time they show? Okay.
So I don't know if maybe the color was... But when he squirts it into the handkerchief, it's purple. Definitely purple.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
A great diaper ad, too, where he's shooting hundreds of milliliters into his handkerchief.
I don't know if it's a shooting error or if it's just the way that the color timing works or whatever. I'll have to go back and look. But yeah, no, it's interesting. I wasn't thinking about it from Six's point of view, in terms of where this falls in the quote-unquote alternate
chronology of these things.
I was thinking, after we watched this, I was thinking, when this is over, if we both have enough cognitive memory of all of the episodes, we should...
Sketch out a...
We should come up with our own orders and talk about, you know, why or what.
Yeah.
That might be really boring. I don't know.
No, but I was starting now. I mean, I can't do that. I do... I don't know if I can convince you, but I do get the distinct feeling that this episode should go earlier.
Mm.
Or that maybe the fact that Ben is a much later episode, which I kind of laughed at when you brought it up. But it seems like his plan and Ben seems like the ultimate sort of thing.
Right.
And in this one, it's a much smaller, and he's much less suspicious of what's going on around him. Even though he's having the same dream endlessly.
Well, see, that's the thing, because I don't think that he is less suspicious, because I do feel like he right away knows something, as I said, right away knows something is wrong. He doesn't know what. And it's not until he breaks into the lab that he knows exactly what it is.
Right.
And he's much more active in beating number two and breaking the plan. Whereas in Chimes of Big Ben, like I said, he thinks he's smarter than everybody else and doesn't think...
Yeah, that's true.
And whereas in this one, he is actively trying to defeat number two.
Right.
But no, it is interesting to look at it both ways, because I can see what you're saying. Looking at it from number six point of view, you could put it earlier. But on my end, looking at it from number two's point of view, things on his end seem much more frantic and much more pressured.
Right.
Where, you know, if... It's tough to talk about this because I know how it ends.
Right, okay.
We can probably have this discussion much easier after we watch the whole thing.
Come back in 16 episodes, click, and my mind will be blown. No, that's fine. We don't have to... it's nothing to really hang on to. It's just sort of a general sense, I guess, I get from that episode.
It is fun to tell... I mean, knowing that this concept is out there, it is kind of fun to dick around and talk about you know, where goes what.
Yep. So he sabotages the experiment.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the plot here is sort of starting to fall apart. He's now actively trying to avoid getting drugged, yet he does anyway.
Well, that's something that I definitely want to talk about, because I've watched this twice in the last like 2 days.
Yep.
And I can't figure out that last time when they bring him in, if he fakes getting drugged, or if the water is just also drugged.
I saw it as the water was drugged.
Yeah.
But he was also having, I thought during his whole sequence, they were acting as though he was having a super intense reaction to the injection drug, which I didn't understand because he made it water or whatever the hell it was.
Yeah.
So I was having a hard time. I was really confused by whether or not his plan was working or if he's actually not in control of the situation at that point. And it obviously bears out that he eventually is.
Right.
I didn't think the script was very strong about explaining where he is in this situation. Although it's interesting, and I assume, well, no, because he's being watched. I was going to say, I assume he drinks the water because he doesn't know it's drugged, and why would you fake drinking it if you could just pass out and like hit your head? But he's always being watched, so I suppose he has to pretend.
Right, yeah, because when he...
But if the water's not drugged, they would just say, we didn't drug the water. Why the hell did he fall down like that?
Yeah, it's a weird thing because you have to, I mean, if, so going into the third round, he knows that the tea is drugged. So he pours that down the sink.
Right.
And then pours himself a glass of water, drinks the water.
Does something I've never seen. Do you run the water before you get a cup of water? Sometimes?
Yeah, if it's just to make sure it's cold.
Oh, I was traumatized by this like elementary school report where they're like, you have to run the water for like 30 seconds before you drink it because there's all that shit in the pipes and it washes it all out.
Oh, wow, I never thought
And so
about that.
I have never just held a glass under the thing, turned it on, and then immediately turned it off when the cup was full.
Yeah, well, I mean, you don't know how many spiders are in that pipe.
you don't want
a mouthful of spiders.
You've seen the house centipedes that are in this area, these goddamn things.
I'll tell you, not to go totally off tangent, but the time that I was done with those guys is I went, I used to have my studio set up in the basement, so I had all my shit up there, and you know, it's everything is much dirtier than you think it is.
Much danker.
Yeah, and one day I went to use my printer, and I reached over, turned the printer on, and like four of them just came squiggling out, and I was like, that's it, and clearly after that happened, I burned the house to the ground.
Yeah.
Salted the earth.
Kicked open the basement door like he did in this episode and slammed your hand on the desk. Like, get out of here.
But sorry.
Fuck house centipedes.
I don't even know if they do anything, but they are the... Ugh.
I did research. They're good. They like eat bad bugs. Oh, okay. But I'm like, if you're a good guy, you cannot look like you are hellspawn that has come from, you know, the center of the earth to take my life.
If it comes down to those or spiders, I don't know whose team I'm going to be on because they both look like they were sent from hell.
That's exactly right. They're different versions of the same hellish number two. I don't need them in my life.
He pours out his tea because he knows that's drugged, and then he drinks a glass of water.
Yep.
And, you know, he kind of smiles before he does it. And then he, on his way to the bedroom, slows down, stumbles, and falls over. And I couldn't figure out if he was faking it because he's trying to have as much control over the situation as
he can. He has to initiate the actual procedure.
Yeah, or if the water was drugged as well. Because, I mean, if let's say he was faking it.
Yeah.
I don't know how... Okay.
Water's got to be drugged.
It works. It still works if the water's not drugged, because at the beginning of the episode, I was listening this time, they don't actively say the stuff that they're broadcasting are his dreams. They don't use that word. They say it's electrical impulses, blah, 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 blah. It's his thoughts.
Right.
So, theoretically, let's say the water is not drugged and he's faked it, right?
Right.
They bring him in. He's actually awake.
Yep.
They juice him up with that stuff that's been watered down so it doesn't have as much of a hold. And so he's still awake so he can actively control the construct that they're putting him in.
Right.
I'm
willing to buy that. It falls apart plot-wise as why he's pouring the water out and the tea. It's really just the fact that he's being observed all the time. And if the water was not drugged, they would be like... Why did he pass out? There's nothing in the water. He didn't drink the tea.
Right. That's the other thing. There has to be some sort of... You have to assume that for whatever reason, there's no camera by the sink.
Right. And there seems to be a camera behind him. And later on, there's a camera constantly on him.
Right. Yeah.
So I'd assume... If I was looking at this, I'd have to assume that the water is drugged.
Yeah.
And at that point... It's just kind of a weird, it's kind of a silly script thing. It's like they should have chose one way to go or the other. Like, he should have actively chose to, Like, you should have taken the tea, winked, and then drank the tea or something, you know, like a little nod to the camera of, like, I know what I'm doing.
But yeah, so the third part of Number Two's plan, I think, was he must have been coming down to the due date for his report and just really kind of, like, wrote the bare bones of this last part.
Sure.
Because where the first two parts are very specific people, C is, there's no picture, there's no name, it's just known to frequent these parties and was a known associate of Number Six. So it could be literally anybody.
It didn't deserve the binder he gave.
No, it didn't deserve the binder.
I don't think any of them deserve the binder he gave. It was such a callback to bad, like, 8-track technology where the box is huge and, like, the cassette doesn't even fit in the machine all the way. It's so big.
Or, like, the early days of CDs where when you bought a CD, the box it came in was, like, 2 feet tall for some reason.
Right, and when you bought them from the store, it had that plastic bit stuck on the bottom that they would have to, unkey to get it out of. Yeah, but I think he even mentions that they don't have anything on C. So it's bizarre. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very, like, it's a very shot in the dark.
Yeah.
I think it still works to an extent because the way that the second dream plays out, it's a supposedly just a continuation of the same party.
Yeah.
So by the time they get to C, you can assume that, I guess they can assume that Six is going to do the work for them, you know.
I have such logic problems with the plot here because if they're not incepting his idea here, why is he just bringing it up in his dream? You know what I mean? If they don't have any information to feed to start the whole process going like they have previously,
right?
How do they know he's going to just dream up this third person? Which is what he does, which he does because he's in control of the situation.
Right.
But if he's not in control of the situation, you'd be sitting there for years until he eventually dreams of what's going on.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting watching it again. The first time I watched it recently, the other day, I was trying to figure out whether or not he's controlling it the whole time. And if he isn't, does that part of their plan work? And I don't think that it does.
No, it doesn't.
Because for exactly what you're saying, if they don't know who the person is,
they can't start the sequence because every previous dream is started when they're like, put A in the 8-track and they put him in and then he shows up.
If that was what they were going to do, they should have just dropped him into the party with nobody and just seen who popped up.
Right, exactly.
You know, that would make more sense
I'm just surprised they didn't recreate the sequence of him resigning. You know, and be like, wouldn't that be a more natural way to get the information out? Be like, now we'll put in different people into this whole process.
Yeah.
And that would make sense as to why he's dreaming about that constantly in the first place. But yeah, they just put him in this strange sequence where he goes in and immediately he's in control. So we'll just go forward, assuming we know he's in control of the situation. Right. He tells them that C is this Madame
Ungadine.
Is that said in the episode?
Yes, a couple times, yeah.
That she's the third person. Mm-hmm. And this is where the dream actually starts getting dreamy. Someone gives him an earring
it's a very dreamy party.
A very dreamy party.
This is a dreamy party!
Someone gives him an earring and he plays roulette with it and he wins and they give him a key.
Yep.
He plays Number Six.
Yep.
And then, you know, he gets these keys. He brings it to Madame Ungadine. And she and he do the nuclear arms thing where they both insert the key at the same time.
Yep.
And they go in, and that's when he shuts down. Like, the screen goes black, so Number Two can't see what's in there.
Yep.
And that's his plan, although then he goes in the car,
he
right?
He continues this construct.
Right.
Well, first of all, the third dream is, as he says, it's a very dreamy party. And because I'm assuming because there's less of the drug and he's actively fighting it more.
Yep.
It turns into like, it's the first really psychedelic kind of thing that they've, outside of the set design and all that kind of stuff, it's the first really like psychedelic thing they've done on the show where the camera angles start floating around.
Oh, yeah. And
he starts like acting weird.
I wrote down, when the music changes in this third thing, people are like drunk and doing conga lines.
Yep.
And the party is actually a real party. And there's this song in the background. And all I could think about was the cable guy scene where Jim Carrey is karaokeing Jefferson Airplane. Yeah. And I just wanted him to start, you know, because they're playing like this sort of rocking tune in the background. And I just wanted him to grab the mic.
Don't you want somebody to love? Don't you need somebody to love?
And everybody in the background of the party, whereas before it was just kind of like a everybody fancy dress party, just kind of hanging around.
Yep.
Everybody in the background this time is like going as weird as they are.
They're drunk and milfy. Everyone is very old. There are no attractive young women at this party.
And they're like, you know, they're all very actively like stoned, basically.
Yeah,
like they're throwing oranges across the room. And
he dancing.
Six focuses in on a mirror. And he starts like...
The mirror is askew, and he tries to straighten it.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's... You know, you could... Because the show is so heavy on the individual and the self, and being... the self being your own worst enemy kind of thing. I don't know if you could read into the psychological reasons of why he's struggling with a mirror.
Yeah.
Struggling with himself in this mirror.
He's struggling to see himself,
yeah. But yeah, it's definitely the most psychedelic. Like the music that you said is very like 60s
garage rock.
No, yeah, royalty free punk.
Yeah.
But yeah, after they do the key thing, he kind of wakes. 14 says, "Oh, he's coming out," and then they put him back under. I think that's what happens. Is that what happens?
She goes over to him and says something. He's reacting fighting. Strongly to it or something like that.
And they continue this construct, and Angadine takes him in the car to meet her boss.
Who is a letter that this guy, number two, had not thought of.
And which is where 14 like very sarcastically says, oh, we should call him D.
Call him D.
Well, she should be like, should call you D.
I'll give you the D. So, and I love that because I kept forgetting that they're in Paris, but he's driving obviously on a green screened Arc de Triomphe is in the background he's driving through Paris, and it was lovely.
And then they pull up to a
Notre Dame, I'd assume.
At one point, I think it's in the first dream actually, they pull up to like a church that I'm pretty sure is just in Port Marion because I think it's the same church that they go into for the art contest.
And,
but you know, you got to use what you have.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, it would be the same thing.
So yeah, they get to the end of this drive and he meets Angadine's boss, who's this like like Phantom of the Opera looking guy with a cape with the red trim underneath and a fedora and a black mask.
Very oh god, I'm gonna fuck it up. The Watchman Rorschach mask, except without the changing like colors or whatever.
He looks like the shadow or something. An old pulp
with a velvet cape with like the red interior.
And also very, very James Bond, because you know you're meeting this
super villain
basically. And they talk about, you know, they get into a back and forth and whatnot, and I find this part of the sequence really interesting. I don't know when exactly it was written, but another reason I think it places it later in the sequence of episodes is because they have a back and forth where Six is kind of getting physical and he's trying to go for the mask and stuff. And he wants to see who is under the mask. And the guy under the mask says, does it matter?
Does it matter?
And Six replies with, it does to them.
We mustn't disappoint them,
the people who are watching.
Right.
And I feel like that's, you know, if this is a later episode, I feel like that makes so much more sense because it's almost like a meta comment, because one of the big things in the show is, well, who is number one? Who is, you know, we got to figure out who number one is.
Right.
And this unmasking is, it's a comment on that. It seems like it could be a comment on that, seeming like, well, why, who cares who the top number is? Like, well, the people who are watching are the people who care. And the person in this instance who's watching is number two,
right,
who is very engaged. Like, he's the thing I found really interesting was, like, there's a certain point where it should be clear that number six is messing with their thing.
Yes.
But two is so into or so desperate to find out the answers that he completely disregards that and just is like, I want to know who this, I want to know who it is. He's basically watching TV at that point.
Yeah, he sort of, he like crawls up to the screen and is like, touch it, like,
yeah, like as soon as they, because I was thinking, another reason why I couldn't figure out if any of their plot made sense after a certain point in the third dream,
right,
is because if Six is going to meet this person who is the boss of Madame Angadine,
yes,
that implies that Six should already know that guy exists. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that ties into my whole...
Yeah.
He can't... Right. His, you get into a whole bunch of like weird logic problems when you start trying to explain in the dreams where he's coming from. Which, yeah, like him knowing who that would be without him ultimately controlling it, which he is doing. Yeah, it's just kind of strange that... And then he reveals this masked man to be number two,
mm-hmm.
who is in his dream. And what I thought was the most clever sequence is they're watching him and he basically goes back to the village and walks in the door.
Yep.
And he doesn't come in the door in real life, but he's in the dream sort of interacting with them mm-hmm. who are in his dream world.
And even then, Six comes in and he's like, oh, I forgot to give you this package of papers you've been after.
That he's been trying to give to this masked man.
Right. And even at that point, number six in real life is like, take it! Take it! Read it! What does it say?
Don't let it, you fool! Open it! I must see what's in it.
It's great. And he gives them, and it's travel brochures because he was trying to travel, in his intro sequence.
And, you know, even at the end of the episode, even though they imply that number two's job is on the line because he gets another ominous call on the giant phone,
mm-hmm.
You can argue that he has gotten the most information out of Six up to this point because he at least finds out that Six was not switching sides.
He's done something that none of the other number twos, he's eliminated an option, which no one else seemed particularly interested in.
Right,
so
exactly.
He should keep his job in for the bare minimum of actually getting something out of the way.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I don't believe he'll be back, right?
He does show up.
Oh, he shows up.
Yeah. That's all I'm going to say. We can talk about it. We can talk about that when it happens.
Absolutely. So, where do you stand on this thing?
There's a couple other things I wanted to say. Well, first of all, if you had to rate number two's plan this time, I don't know how often we're going to be able to do this because the plots vary and stuff.
Sure.
But as often as we can, it's, you know, why not? If you had to scale of 1 to 6, 6 being obviously
it works. Yeah. So it's really a 1 to 5, unless this show goes a weird place after 3 episodes. It's a 2.
Yeah.
He's working with untested technology that doesn't really make logical sense in terms of a story.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not really all that involved. He doesn't really do much.
Yeah.
It's just kind of, I had real plot problems with this episode, which I'm always willing to give a little bit to a dream sequence just mm-hmm. because you have to, because things are just going to be like, nothing makes sense when you start exploring dreams and how they interact with people. But it seemed really thrown together, which I think makes sense in terms of this number two being so nervous, but I think it makes the episode sort of a weaker once you start thinking about it. You're like, I don't really know what's happening here.
Yeah. I think I'd probably say it's a 2 as well.
Yeah.
For you know, the reasons we've covered, where, I mean, it's obviously not a 6. Take off a point because it doesn't work. Take off another point because it's untested material.
Yeah.
Take off another point because
he doesn't guard the lab that they're doing all this in. It's very loosey-goosey.
And, you know, take off another point because
his obsession with milk. Which, why did they even have that? What was the point of the milk?
I don't know. I think, well, they do this other thing that's just kind of like a subtle contrast or a parallel to Six, where as Six is having these deep, deep dreams, Two is getting worse and worse nights of sleep. Like, after the first dream, when Six comes in to talk to him, he's like, oh, how are you? And he's like, oh, I haven't been sleeping very well. I've slept great.
I suppose that's true.
There's that other scene later where he's like, where he literally shows up, Two literally comes up in the circular chair in his dressing gown. He's like, I just can't sleep. I
I've been down there for hours.
So yeah, I don't know if it's just a warm milk going to bed thing.
I was spending, 30 minutes of the episode being like, someone, his dream is going to break when someone's like, would you like some milk with that? and that would be the giveaway.
Yeah.
It's a strange thing to just put into an episode. Like,
yeah,
pour me some milk. It's kind of a, because none of the other number twos have had quirky traits like that.
Come in, my dear fellow. Come and sit down.
I'm not tired. I slept well.
Good. We don't seem to have seen a lot of each other.
I haven't seen very much of you.
I don't spend all my time spying.
Don't you? Your predecessors did.
I have other things to do. Now, all this nonsense about why you resigned. If people can't chuck up a job, things have come to a pretty pass, do sit down.
I'm still not tired.
In that case, perhaps you'd pour me out some milk. I didn't have a very good night.
The one thing I do like about it, though, is that the break in the dream doesn't come when, at some point in the second dream, the girl asks him, or maybe both of them do, ask him why he resigned.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciated that that wasn't the break for the second, for 2 weeks in a row.
It got dangerously close.
Yeah.
I wrote down, they need to stop being so heavy-handed with this resign business. Yeah. Like, you gotta ease yourself into that. Because every time someone asks him why he resigned, his eyebrows go up.
Mm.
It's like, okay, like you've given.
Yeah, I mean, I'm willing to buy that in this dream or whatever, it doesn't click the same way it does.
Right.
And the stuff that actually does click is the more concrete stuff that he recognizes from his life and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
So yeah, I'd say as far as plans go, ambition is probably a 5.
Yeah.
Execution probably like a 2.
Yeah.
Especially because he, at the end, he gets caught up in watching reality television to the point where he doesn't realize that 6 is just messing with him.
Right, yeah. He doesn't seem the brightest of the number 2s.
Yeah.
He knew all the time he was playing with you.
Not John Fail.
No, he succeeded.
What'd you think of the episode overall?
I liked it. One of the things that I really liked, especially thinking about it this time, was I thought it was a great blend of genres. In, you know how in Star Trek they do the really great episode where they go back to the 40s or something, and it's like, oh, well, it's Spock with a fedora on hiding his ears, whatever. Yep. They do that kind of stuff a lot where it's sort of a gimmicky side inside the same concept.
Sure.
This felt like a legit blend of genres where you were doing a spy story that was also a sci-fi story.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you take out the dream sequence stuff, or I should say, if you take out all of the village stuff and just focus on the dream sequence stuff,
sure,
it's still a solid episode of a spy show.
Yes.
Because you've got these people competing to try and, until you get... Yeah, even when you get to the end, when you get to the big villain with the mask and all that kind of shit.
Yeah. Someone's got some information.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue, I don't know the extent of McGoohan's involvement with this particular script. I know that he allegedly had his hands on pretty much everything.
Yep.
But given where he comes from Danger Man and all that kind of stuff, you really could, and especially given what I was talking about, that monologue that, or that back and forth he has at the end,
yep,
you could look at this episode as being some kind of comment on the spy genre and the formula that it follows and that kind of stuff.
Yep.
But yeah, I think overall I find it a really good mixture of genres.
Yeah, I'd agree with that of the fact that I wrote down the Inception / Total Recall / so there's a lot of things going into this episode. I tend to stick with plot errors kind of tend to drive me a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
And just because I know, it's one thing if the show is like so avant-garde that it's like, oh, the plot is sort of secondary to whatever's going on. But the previous episodes show that that's not really the case. So they do have there is something grounding it. And I think that this episode was just a little bit, it missed the mark on too much of the dream stuff where it was like distracting me to the point of not really getting it. And again, it happens in the 60s when I'm not sure what the state of dream sequences was. So it's like, You know, and it's not the Sopranos stuff, you know, where eventually you get to dream sequences in modern television where everything is just a symbol of what's going on.
Right.
And you sort of have to figure out what everything means to you or to the main character. And this one, it was not that way. So I'd mark this one down a little bit below the Ben's, the Big Ben.
Yeah, I you know, I honestly don't know, given all that, I don't know what other show at the time, save for like Doctor Who, would even attempt something like this.
Yeah.
Like Twilight Zone, obviously, Star Trek, maybe it had, I don't know. I don't remember much of the original series of Star Trek.
What years was Prisoner?
67 to 68.
Okay, so this is post-Star Trek, the original series, okay.
But I, you know, I think it's a pretty, you know, what's the word? It's, I think it's ahead of its time a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think the whole show is ahead of its time.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
And so, you know, given that, I give it some passes in areas for, you know,
blazing the trail.
Yeah, but I can definitely see what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah.
My handbook on social etiquette doesn't deal with this. How does one talk to someone that one has met in a dream?
Well, I guess other than that, the only thing left is to do a trivia, which will also be kind of short, because the only trivia that I really have is, despite umbrellas being a fixture in the show, this is the only episode in the series that features rain. And only tangentially, because in the opening sequence when there's the thunder and they bring him in wrapped in plastic and stuff.
Oh, right.
That's the only episode of the show where they actively change the weather.
Oh, well, there you go. And yeah, why were they bringing him in that bag anyway?
I don't know. Okay. Well, I assume because it was raining out and they just wrapped him up like a dead body for some reason.
Well, that's that's fascinating. We didn't see an umbrella in this episode. It might be the first episode without an umbrella, too.
Yeah. Oh, and also the guys who come in are wearing rain jackets and boots, and she's like, take off your Max and
boots. Take off your slickers or whatever she says, and it's just very strange. But yeah, it was a interesting episode. I think I did prefer Big Ben a little bit, but
The moving forward, I'd say it's a little, you know, you're gonna get a lot of different stuff.
Yep.
It's not always so directly on six, trying to break six and all that kind of stuff. Sometimes it gets weirder than this. Sometimes it's really straightforward. So,
right. Looking forward to it. It'll be interesting.
So that's it for A, B, and C. We'll be back next time with Free for All, which I believe is the first episode written and directed by McGoohan himself.
His vision come to life.
Yes. Yeah, it's a pretty interesting one. Okay. But yeah, thanks again for listening. If you'd like to get in touch with us and yell at me for anything I've gotten wrong, you can follow us on Twitter at Prisoner Podcast, or you can email us at theprisonerpodcast@gmail.com. Wes, thank you again. Do you have anything you'd like to plug?
Me and you occasionally do some Star Trek episodes on a podcast, the Next Generation podcast. So you can go to the PenskePodcast.com for all that stuff.
Excellent. And we now have a brand new, as of the recording of this, it's a brand new website, but, by the time you hear this, it will be old. So you can
close down.
Yeah.
I'm not paying these fucking fees anymore.
You can find all the episodes on, at backinthevillage.com, and hopefully by the time this goes out, we'll be on iTunes and you can download and
not being sued by Iron Maiden or anything.
Yeah, hopefully. Fingers crossed. Hey, shut up. Don't mention where the song is.
Unto the
Yeah. Well, at least it wasn't a Beatles song. I'd already be out.
No, I know. It's because I looked on iTunes for Back in the Village, and it's just there is an Iron Maiden podcast called Back in the Village.
Is there really?
Yeah.
Oh shit.
I think they only have two episodes. Hey, if anyone from iTunes is somehow listening to this podcast, can you clean up all the dead podcasts that are fucking sitting around in iTunes for no particular reason?
Yeah, that would be great.
I don't understand. They should have some kind of algorithm that if you have not posted something in 2 years, your podcast gets taken off the store.
Or if you've got like two episodes.
Two episodes over the course of a year, maybe it's not quite happening for you.
Yeah, or just have a separate folder for Dead Zone or something.
Cool, but thank you guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll see you next time. And thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Well, that's it for A, B, and C. Thanks again for checking us out. Don't forget to check out theunmutual.co.uk, and we'll see you next time with Free For All.